Hello and happy Christmas if you're listening to this the day that I uploaded it. This is a special Christmas programme. Everybody does best ofs. This isn't the best of, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to dedicate the entire show to a chat I had with The Edge in the 80s. Obviously, the 80s were a phenomenal time for U2. Just to give you a brief background, I worked with the band from 1980 onwards, right up to the Joshua Tree, which for me, to be honest, was their best decade. Because Red Rocks, which happened in 5th of June 1983, and how can we forget Live Aid on the 13th of July 1985. And of course, The Unforgettable Fire, which came out on the 1st of October 1984. That was their fourth album, then The Joshua Tree in March 1987. So what happened? I started on the radio in Manchester, where I was living in the UK, in 1984. And we have a little chap from The Edge, which I discovered in the cupboard just during the holidays. And it was The Edge phoning me to wish the programme happy birthday. And we talked about the up-and-coming Live Aid show. So that's kind of gold. And then I went back and dug out some footage and stuff that I had from the four programmes that I did on U2, which are, what are they? They're episodes 15, 16, 17 and 18, if I'm not mistaken. Malcolm Gary talking at Red Rocks, my interview with Adam The Edge, an interview with Bono and The Edge, and other stuff. Oh, my phones are going. Never mind. Sorry about that. So what we're going to do is we're going to roll with it. And U2 was a phenomenal experience for me to work with that band right from the beginning. I got them the first TV, their first radio session, grew up with them. And I suppose you can say the rest is history. And it's incredible to think some 40 years later, I've dug this out and I'm playing it. The audio quality is about as good as it can be from 40 years ago. So bear with me. There's a little bit at the start of the phone interview with The Edge where it's a little low. But you still should be able to hear it. So let's get on with it.
With the way the band's progressed and everything, and here we are sort of 5 years on from the time I saw you play the Polytechnic, for instance, and I was there in that room that Bono refers to where there were nine people there. I was proud to say I was one of them. Would be a bit of an understatement to say you've come a long way since then, but I mean, it is actually a changed U2 now, isn't it, Edge, with the fact that everything is reliant on the total production and the sheer quality of the stage show that you're putting together. It's not relying so much on Bono climbing PA stacks nowadays, etc., is it?
Yeah, there's a certain finesse that we've developed over the last 12 months, and some would say it's long overdue. You know, we've survived for long enough, I think, on just vibe, you know. I always remember watching Wire Heat in their early days, and it seemed to me that they would construct situations like breakdowns of amplifiers and PAs just so Wiley could get on the microphone and abuse the audience and rap with the crowd for a few minutes. And that was great, you know, that works fantastically in a club or a small theatre. But when you start playing large places and your show must project to the very back of the hall, then I think you got to take it a bit more seriously and be a bit more, quote, professional about the whole thing. And we've become aware of this first in the States, where we started doing larger venues about 12 months ago. And with this record, things have just started really coming together and developing to in a direction that we, up till now, really haven't really considered.
It's important to stress, I think, the fact that you knew exactly what you wanted when you approached Dino, wasn't it, in the first place, Edge?
Yeah, that's true. For the first time, we actually had some of the songs already written, and that, in a way, was one of the things that affected our choice of producer. Had the song been more American or something, we may have gone with someone else. But it seemed to us at the time that they really had a very overt European perspective, and we wanted somebody, some producer that could enhance that, and Eno just seemed like a perfect choice. As it turned out, he was more perfect even than we envisaged originally.
You have been on the road since the end of August, haven't you? How long are you going to be touring to promote this latest record, The Unforgettable Fire? You go to America from Britain.
Well, we do a very short tour of the States, only about 2 weeks of dates before Christmas, but that really isn't an American tour, that's just a taster. We go back in the spring and we probably will be there for about 2 or 3 months, which is how long it takes to get to all the major centres in North America. From there, I think we'll probably come home, maybe do one or two festivals, and then just leave it at that. I think everyone in the group is anxious to get back into the studio with someone, maybe Brian again, maybe Danny Lanois, and produce another LP.
Was it an easy record to make, Edge? Did you have a lot of troubles sitting down actually writing for The Unforgettable Fire? Because it was another phase in a totally different band, wasn't it?
Well, we started out with some songs, which we finished to the best of our own abilities. Then Brian and Danny arrived. I suppose we had 15 pieces before they arrived. None of them really finished, but they were certainly well on the way. Instead of finishing those 15, we wrote another 15. So immediately, instead of having the usual kind of LPs worth of material plus two or three, which, you know, we weren't sure about, we had double the amount of stuff we needed. Mainly these were just ideas that hadn't really been developed. So the record immediately changed in identity from what we had envisaged at first. And because of that, I think we weren't really quite sure quite where it was going to end up. That was a really positive thing, I think, in many ways. But because of that, I think it took us a lot longer to finish the songs, to get the finished melodies and lyrics and finished performances of the voice and final takes done. So in that respect, the fact that it did take us 3 months to finish meant that it has been and was a very difficult record to finally, you know, knock on the head. But it was an intensely gratifying session, you know. It was very inspiring, very challenging. And it seemed like, you know, a couple of weeks, you know, when you look back on it. It really doesn't seem like it was 3 months at all.
The first track we're going to hear, Pride, I think it'd be fair to say that it is an obvious single, isn't it, to be taken from the album. But you've never been a band, Edge, concerned with writing hit singles, have you? I mean, if there's a track on the album or whatever that happens to be commercial, I think New Year's Day was probably commercial and the right record at the right time to give you top 10 status, and like with having a top 3 single with Pride. It's a crossover record, but you've never really worried, have you?
No, our emphasis has always been on the LPs, on creating an album of material that has some sort of ebb and flow and works as a collection of pieces. With this song, Pride, I think the essence of the song is very simple, and that's probably why it makes sense as a 45. The original structure was a lot more complex, and it was Eno's influence, I think, that led us to cut it down, to strip it down to the bare essentials of the piece. And in so doing, I think we produced probably one of our only true single releases. So, I mean, it wasn't envisaged originally as a 45, but it just became obvious, you know, when we mixed it, that it was actually a song that could go very far in the charts.
The next track, Edge, is the title track from the album, The Unforgettable Fire.
It's actually my favourite track on the record at the moment. I tend to change my opinion from just at the moment. That is it. It's a song that started its life quite a while ago as just a little piano piece, and developed from there to the track that's on the record. We demoed it before Brian and Danny arrived, and the nice thing about that song is that the essential musical qualities that it had as a piano piece and as a demo are still there as a final track on the record, but it's just stated in a far stronger, more confident way. It's one of the nicest pieces I think we've ever done as a band. Yeah, it's really funny how times change, you know, and policies change in the sub-editorial side of these sort of magazines. But I honestly believe that they're really cutting their own throats, because they're getting so cynical and so negative that it's honestly, it's penance reading them now. I never read those things anymore. Very few musicians that I know of read them, or if they do, it's just
in secret.
They just maybe pick one up every couple of months if there's something particularly that interests them. But really, who wants to pick up papers like that and read this sort of trash that they're putting out. It's just so depressing. That's the only word for it. You read it and you feel, my God, you know, what's this business all about? Let's just pack it in and open greengrocer's shops or something. It's just, you know, what more can you say?
Bad's an interesting title, Edge. Did you have much trouble thinking up a title like that?
It seemed actually quite an obvious one. In fact, it was so obvious that we questioned it originally. One of the early inspirations for that song was a certain repetitive quality that the Velvet Underground would have used in their early days. And the song, lyrically, was, I think, seemed to be dedicated to a friend of Bono's who was going through a very bad time with heroin. So the whole thing, I mean, that title suggested itself quite early on in the making of the song. So it was one of those working titles that we weren't sure about, and then when it came to the end of the record, we had to make a decision. And I think everyone was convinced that that was the title, really, and that nothing else could sum everything up quite so well.
It's not fair to still refer to you as a guitar band now, is it, Edge? I mean, you are progressing, and I think you will attract a lot more fans through this album. And, well, I say critics as opposed to reviewers, but generally it's been looked on quite favourably. Are you pleased?
Yeah, very pleased. When we first decided to ask Brian to produce, assuming that he was going to do it, we felt that it would be possibly a commercial failure of a record. I mean, Brian said himself, he said, look, if you want me to produce something commercial, I've never produced a commercial album in my life. And if you look back at his history, he's produced some very influential work, but nothing that has meant a commercial turning point in a band's career, quite the opposite. But we decided that at this stage in our career, that really wasn't what we were worried about. And the LP that we finally ended up with has just been way above my expectations in that respect. It's a record that displays the many abilities within the group to their best advantage. It's more of a representation of the band than any of the other records. It shows more of the contrast of the group with songs like Pride, the way that is so concise, so simple, and yet so strong, down to things like 4th of July, the story of that track is myself and Adam were just playing together a few little figures in the castle where we were doing our basic recording, and we weren't even aware that it was being listened to, but Brian was in the other room, the control room, and he just was listening to what we were doing, had a few treatments up, which he quite liked, and so he put the quarter-inch machine on. That's just the stereo machine. So it was like a live recording. So it went down, and then we decided to put it on the record. So, you know, it's total contrasts in this record. It's definitely my favourite of our so far.
I'd be inclined to agree with that.
You're listening to the Christmas edition special of Moments That Rock, part of the Panting Group of podcasts. This one is with The Edge from U2. The 80s were a phenomenal time for them. The bit you've heard was about the album The Unforgettable Fire. It was originally out on my radio show in Manchester in 1985, I think. No, 84. Anyway, it went out as a Christmas special, and we're repeating a little bit of it here. And this bit that's coming up now, after the break, will be The Edge again. And he phoned me up when the radio show was a year old to wish the programme a happy birthday. So this bit is 1985.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
5 years, and the previous bit was 1984. We'll be back in a moment.
Hello?
Hello, who's that?
Hello, Tony, this is The Edge here from U2. I'm just ringing up to wish you a happy birthday and you know, for the first birthday of the last radio show.
Oh, well, that's very decent of you indeed. I'm very grateful. How sweet of you. Listen, I had a phone call on Friday from REM. They said they thoroughly enjoyed your show and performing with you at Milton Keynes.
Yeah, they're a great bunch of guys. Actually, we had them over to Dublin as well for our show in Croke Park.
How did that go?
It was amazing.
Was that about the same amount of people, Edge?
In fact, a little more than we had at Milton Keynes, I think. The restrictions at Milton Keynes were around 50,000. We were allowed to sell upwards to 60,000 tickets for the Irish show, so it was about 60. But it was a great day. I mean, you can imagine what a recipe for, you know, an occasion. U2 playing the hometown after 2 years of absence. And it was also Dublin's festival week, so everybody was in incredibly kind of jubilant form. It was amazing. We just lit the touch paper and stood back, and the whole thing just went.
Did you have better weather?
Yeah, that was another plus point. I mean, the Milton Keynes show was—it wasn't spoiled by the rain. Far from it. In fact, it was an extremely good show. I mean, our audience were unbelievable. But the Croke Park show had better weather, and I think as a result, people were more relaxed, and it was just a sort of carnival atmosphere in the audience. So, I mean, it was just one of those once-in-a-lifetime experiences. Really, it was great. I was proud to be on stage. Really.
Yeah, it is. In fact, it's not only just our birthday, Edge. You've got something to celebrate yourself, haven't you? I mean, it's virtually the end of your world tour. You've been on tour since August the 29th.
That's right. Yeah, it seems like we've been on tour for the whole of our lives, you know. But it's been such an incredible tour for us. It's seen a transition, I suppose, in the States and in England and Europe as well, for the group from being a kind of fairly up-and-coming successful group into being, I suppose, just one of the most successful groups around. And, you know, it's been so significant for us that it's been on this album, The Unforgettable Fire record, produced by Brian Eno, our attempt to break the mold and step out in a new direction that has been the album that has brought us up to this level. It's been great. And it indicates to me that the true understanding, you know, that people have of the group, the people that buy our albums.
I remember talking to you at the NEC gig, that one of the last dates on the British tour in the autumn, and you were saying that your show's much more geared towards stadiums now, isn't it, after playing like the small intimate clubs and then the concerts, and now here you are playing like with 30,000 people or people sat in a field watching you.
Yeah, it's been a difficult transition, and for a long time we were extremely nervous about it. When we first started playing, you know, that was the last thing that we ever imagined happening. Us ended up in stadiums, you know, or arenas. It just seemed totally inappropriate. But as the band has developed and you know, having played a couple of the shows over a year ago, we figured out that actually it wasn't such an odd situation to see you two in. And at this stage now, having experienced them a lot, we've discovered that we're extremely at home in arenas, and that far from our shows suffering, it seems to just become far bigger and rise to the challenge of these larger venues. It's remarkable. I mean, I'm sure that people at the very back get a different show to people down the front, but as far as I'm concerned, having played these places, it's the audience themselves that make the whole thing work, not necessarily the group on stage. And our audiences, they seem to be just so positive that no matter where you are in an arena or in the stadium, the atmosphere is the same. same. And that's the thing that people really, I think, come to our shows for, is that total positive feeling amongst all the people.
Yeah, I suppose 11,000 for a U2 gig like the NEC isn't that many nowadays, is it? The actual sound inside there could have been a small club.
Yeah, I mean, something that someone said to me, which I really believe is true, you can go to a club where there's 10 people and feel absolutely nothing, you know, totally cut away from what's going on stage, and yet you can be in an arena and feel just almost like you're on stage with the band themselves. I don't believe that the venues are the problem. I think if a show doesn't have that spark, it's the band and the audience that are at fault.
What are you going to do with yourself now, Edge? I mean, now you're not going to have any gigs. You can't get 50,000 people in your living room.
True. Well, we've got a lot of stuff we have to do, you know. We have this Unforgettable Fire album out now, you know, for a year, and we want to start getting back into the studio and writing some songs. So we're doing three more shows, and then we call it a day for the next record. We're doing two festivals in Belgium, Tourhoek and Werchter, and then we're doing the famous Band-Aid show.
Of course, yeah.
14th of July at Wembley. So we're almost on the last lap, you know, and what a way to finish. I think that shows, I mean, it's already, you know, legendary status. I can't wait until, you know, it actually happens. I think it's going to be great.
That's going to be quite an emotional occasion, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I should imagine there'll be very few dry eyes behind stage after that one.
A potential audience of a billion, is that right?
I think when you add up all the TV stuff, it must easily be that.
No bum notes there, eh, Edge?
Well, we've got four songs, you know, not like a whole set, so we'd be extremely anxious to pull it off without any hitches or that, yeah.
Do you know what you're going to be doing?
There are some obvious contenders, but we haven't actually picked the four. I mean, stuff like I Will Follow Sunday, Bloody Sunday, New Year's Day, Unforgettable Fire, Pride. I mean, these are the songs that we're talking about, but because, as I say, we've got 20 minutes, which really means about four songs, we're going to have to leave some classics out. We're just going to have to decide. I presume it'll probably be the day before or something. Things you just got on that stage and you do it or you don't. And I think in the past we were quite good at that. You know, we have this reputation for being the kind of underdogs that really happened on the day. So we're keeping our fingers crossed that we still have that ability.
One thing, Edge, last time we spoke, you spoke about all these outtakes from the Unforgettable Fire, and we've seen quite a few on B-sides and things now.
Yeah,
and I've just got this brilliant version of Bad, U2 Wide Awake in America.
That's the live version. Yeah.
Where was that recorded?
In fact, that, I think, might be the NEC show.
Oh, really?
We did a little bit of catching up on some of the vocals, because Bono was having a lot of problems hearing himself on that show, but as far as I know... NEC show.
Oh, that's great. I was there. Wonderful.
Yeah.
Oh,
I mean, it's a great, great version. It really is. It's got so much power to it.
Just before you go, can I ask you one question? When we spoke, you said you had a whole bunch of material that you'd written for the Unforgettable Fire. When you come to make your new album, are you going to ditch that, or are you going to go and write a whole bunch of new songs again?
I'm sure we'll write again, but I wouldn't discount the possibility of some of those unfinished works turning up as finished pieces on the next record. When we start recording, you know, we will go for whatever we find around ourselves, and you know, we can dig up some really old backing tracks, old forgotten ideas, and sometimes they just inspire us to work on them again and produce finished works. Sometimes that really works out very well.
So when can we expect to realistically see you two tour Britain again? Are we looking towards the autumn of 86?
Blimey. I suppose it's definitely not going to be early in 86. Mm. I would imagine, yeah. Late 86, we'll probably be doing a few shows.
Would you want to get an album out for the spring?
I doubt if we'll have it out by then. I think we'll probably have the album out by the summer, maybe early autumn, and be touring sort of around that same time.
Brian Eno again?
That's still not decided. I think there's a good chance that Danny and Brian will be involved, but we still haven't, you know, decided finally. In a way, I think, in the same way that Unforgettable Fire, the songs decided the producer, I think it might well be that way again.
Well, listen, Edge, I do appreciate you calling. I mean, this means a lot to me, and I'm very, very grateful, especially on one of those rare U2 days off. I know you want to spend it with your family. And Holly's birthday next week.
That's right, yeah.
So I'm not one to mither you anymore. I don't need to wish you good luck, because I think there's millions and millions of people all over the world behind you, and your records are only getting better anyway.
Oh, well, thank you, Tony. You're very kind.
What a sycophant, eh?
Well, listen, you know, have a good show, you know. It's great to think that you've been on the air for a whole year.
Great or a miracle?
Yeah, it seems like only yesterday that, you know, you were telling us about your show, and, everyone was really excited about it, so
well, listen,
congratulations.
Well, thank you very much for all the support, and I sincerely hope that we'll have a chat when you're back in Manchester. It doesn't really matter. I mean, I'll come anywhere to talk to you, let's face it.
Okay, Tony.
Love to all the family, Edge. Is there anything you want to hear that I can play for you after this interview, rather than instead of just your own stuff? Any particular favourite?
Well, actually, of the stuff that we've just released, I really like The Three Sunrises. I think that's got a lot of...
Okay, but apart from your own material, is there anything by anybody else you might want to hear? Great. You know, honestly, next to yourselves, the most letters I get are about the Waterboys, and we're hoping to put a concert on by the Waterboys in the autumn, so...
Great.
I tell you what, I thought of playing Savage Earthheart this week.
Yeah, why not?
So maybe I'll play that.
Yeah, that'd be great.
The Edge, love to everyone out there.
Okay.
Thank you very much indeed.
Okay, Tony, listen, it was a pleasure.
Yeah, hold on while I wipe away the tears. The Edge talking to me twice, actually, once in an interview that he did with Adam... which went out as a special on the radio station, Piccadilly Radio in Manchester, that I was working at the time. And then after being on there for a year, he phoned me back. And that's why the quality's a little iffy, but I heard it, so hopefully you heard it. And it was really interesting, the stuff they were saying. I mean, absolutely incredible to hear about talking up about what they were going to do at Live Aid and mentioning stuff like, you know, we'll probably do New Year's Day and I Will Fall on Sunday, Bloody Sunday and Pride. Well, you know, the whole thing was we were all waiting on them doing Pride. And, of course, Bono went walk around and badly lasted for about, I don't know, 7 minutes or something. And they pulled the plug. And that day, Bono was nearly sacked from the band. 1985. Incredible to think about it now. But he just went walkabout, pulled his girl out of the crowd, but it turned into pretty much a moment that rocked, actually. Certainly rocked for them, but Bonner was very close to being sacked. And the rest is history, especially with an audience of 1.4 billion people. Taking a walkabout and where the band can't find you is not always the best idea, but he's never stuck by rules. And a couple of things worked. I mean, the other thing was Red Rocks. Red Rocks, it was kind of pouring with rain and in danger of being electrocuted. They decided to go on and do it at the time. Mike Peters talks about that gig in the previous Moments That Rock. The full interview with Bono and Adam is available here. Programmes, episodes 15, 16, 17, 18 are all about you two. So if you delve back through the archives, you'll be able to find them. Anyway, you have been listening to Moments That Rock with me, Tony Michaelides. We're part of the Pantheon Group of podcasts and proud to be there. Have a happy Christmas and everything else that goes with it. Don't drink too much or fall over, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.